The musical Fun Home has been called groundbreaking, exquisite, and unforgettable, winning 5 2015 Tony Awards, including Best Musical, and making history along the way. Based on Alison Bechdel's best-selling graphic memoir, Fun Home introduces us to Alison at three different ages as she explores and unravels the many mysteries of her childhood. Kate Chindel is a former Miss America, the current president of Actors Equity, and is now starring as Alison Bechdel in the touring production of Fun Home, now playing at Proctor's Theater in Schenectady through November 5th. It is an absolute blast to welcome Kate Chindel to the roundtable this morning. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for asking. I think you're the first person to ask that question today. I appreciate that. My goodness. Well, I love the show. I love the show when I first saw it on Broadway. And it's a show that I didn't know what to expect when I saw it. And then you see it and it just changes you in some way. Mm-hmm. And when did it first come on your radar?
I knew about the show. I had been working mostly out of town the year that it opened on Broadway, but obviously it got a lot of acclaim. It won 5 Tonys, including Best Musical, and
right.
And everybody was talking about this show. But I didn't actually see it until January of 2016, which is around the time they started casting for the tour. And I felt the same way you did. I felt I was pretty haunted by it. I was definitely moved by it, and I jumped at the opportunity to try and get an audition to take this out on the road, because as much as it's an important show in New York, I felt like it was also a really important show to tour across the country at this particular moment.
You've been with it for how long now?
We started rehearsals in August 2016, and then we started performances in October, so just over a year of shows.
So what has it been like? I mean, this has been, I'm going to put, let me bury the lead here, but it's been a turbulent year.
Yeah.
So what has it been like to take the show into some of the most beautiful theaters in some small cities to see how it's people react to it?
It's been amazing. I mean, the writer part of me wants to immediately sit down and write a book about this. And I actually started taking some notes, and then I found out I was kind of busy with the show and all the other stuff that
and your 8 other jobs have, yes.
But I expected it to be a really fascinating experience, and that was before the election, right?
Right.
So it has been incredibly well received, I would say, as a general rule across the country, both critically and by audiences. And the tour recouped its investment within 6 months, so it's been financially successful as well. That said, it's hard not to notice the differences between places. Like, there's a line in the show where someone is referred to as a butch.
Yes.
Which in San Francisco, that's just a word. You know, it's not. But in a lot of places, it gets a laugh, which is fascinating to me, because I don't know if it's a laugh just because it makes people uncomfortable or because they think it's supposed to be a joke. In Seattle, it's just a word people use. But in some other places, it is startling in a way. And I think that's a very small example of the fact that different audiences and different communities react in different ways. I mean, we've had people leave during the show, which I think is a shame, because this is a true story based on someone's actual life. So
right.
you're not just walking out on a musical that I made up in my basement. You're actually walking out on somebody's real life and experiences. But I would also point out that is the vast, vast minority of audience members who, you know, anytime somebody leaves, there are hundreds of people who stay and you know, jump to their feet at the end, which is exciting.
Well, you do have to wonder of what it says about us, but also what it says about the importance of this work
mm-hmm.
to be brought around the country and to have been mounted in the first place,
yeah.
And the story that it tells, and the importance of as you rightly noted, especially at this time, to tell that story.
Yeah, you know, when we were about to leave town, about to leave New York, I first said something that got some quizzical looks, right? And it's that I hope that people who feel about the possibility of having an LGBTQ teenager, about coming out stories, things like that. I hope that people who feel about that the way that Allison's mother does in the show come to see our show, because she is quick to say, and so is Allison's father, you know, don't rush to put a label on it. I just, you know, I don't, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but like, I don't want to be dramatic, but this could be catastrophic. And I think there are a lot of people like that who say, you know, their child says, you know what, I think I might be gay. And it's like, wait, maybe it's just a phase. You know, I think that people say that with good intentions. But it reinforces this idea that it's bad to wake up one day and say, you know what, this is who I am. And I feel like, and I've said this a lot lately, that people need to be free to recognize and live their true identity. And bad things can happen when they don't feel that freedom. And Bruce Bechdel, Allison's father, is sort of a case study in that.
You are a straight woman playing a lesbian role. What has that been like for you? And what was the... I remember hearing a story of Alison Bechdel's reaction to you being cast, and I'm just curious as to what that was like a year ago as all this was coming together.
Well, Allison's been really supportive, and I thought that was super cool, and I really appreciated it. She has been such a great supporter of the show in general, and I was very pleased to hear what she said when I was first cast. It was a great relief. You know, I have a lot of thoughts about it. One of them is that I'm an actor, and actors can play all kinds of roles.
Right.
The second is that I am straight, and I think that there's only so much of the coming out experience that you can understand by researching it and talking to friends. There's always going to be maybe 10 or 20% that you just don't get if you haven't lived it. I liken it to playing a parent. If you don't have any kids of your own, you can get close, but you're probably not going to get all the way there. And so I've tried to be as respectful as possible toward that. I've tried to understand friends' narratives and things that I've observed and heard, and to do it as well as I possibly can. It also doesn't hurt that a lot of that part of the story is told by another actor. And so that I think takes a bit of the burden off of me as well. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure that there are people out there who feel like this role should be played always by someone who identifies very closely with that part of the story. And to that, I can only say I've done my best. I hope it has been successful, and I hear you.
So let's just talk about the mechanics of it. You had to cut off your Miss America hair. I mean, that has to be...
You know, Miss America was 20 years. It was half my life ago.
Okay, but you had the long brown hair most of your life.
Well, I mean, my hair was like shoulder length when I started rehearsals for the show. Look, I think that this show is a really good reason to cut your hair. Hair grows back. You know, there's only so much that you can do with wigs, especially out on the road.
Yeah.
And, you know, to pass up an opportunity like this because of a haircut would have been insane, like absolutely insane.
Right. When you start something like this, for you, I mean, for anybody, it's obviously a lot to go out on the road and to make that commitment. But as we noted, you have a lot of jobs. One of them being the president of Actors Equity.
Yep.
Do you feel that this somehow, or I would think greatly, informs you even more as in helping to do that job?
Oh, absolutely. For a couple reasons. First of all, I'm working what's called the CETA contract, which is a short engagement touring agreement. And that's been something that our members have had lots of opinions about in the last several years since it was created. So I'm glad to have been able to go out and work on that contract and make my own observations about what works and what could possibly be improved. That's kind of an inside baseball thing.
Right.
The other thing is that we have three office cities, New York, Chicago, and L.A. And actually, we have an office in Orlando, so four. But mostly we talk about New York, Chicago, and L.A. And then we have 29 what are called liaison cities, which are areas with a concentration of 100 or more members. Buffalo, Rochester is one. Albany is one. And so I've had the chance that I probably never would have had otherwise while the tour is going through these different communities, Dallas-Fort Worth, Seattle, Kansas City, St. Louis, Minneapolis, St. Paul, to sit down with those members and actually talk about what's working for them within their interaction with the union, what they need more of, where we need to focus our resources. There is no way I can imagine that the union would have spent the money to send me to all those places and sit down with all those members if I wasn't already going through. But it has been tremendously informative, and it's actually started to influence our policy. We got all our liaisons together for a conference in July, and we've started to update communication strategies and put resources into working directly with those liaisons to organize more jobs in their local communities. We're talking about enforcement of any number of rules that have just not been as proactively enforced as we could. So it has not only been doable, it's actually, I think, really added a component that I never would have experienced if I'd been in New York this whole time.
And it was not, that was not conscious, I assume? I mean, you go after the role, or do you, or do you think of it as, oh, and I can also do this?
That it wasn't really a factor in whether it, you know, whether or not I pursued or took this job. But as soon as I got this job, we started talking about, okay, how can we make this work really well for the union in a way that it wouldn't have if I was just, you know, just auditioning and working in New York. And we came up with some creative strategies, and, you know, tonight we're having the Albany area membership meeting at Proctor's. They scheduled it while I'm in town so that I can hear directly from as many members as possible. It's going to be great.
When you think of this, I mean, going back to your time when you were Miss America, of working, your cause was AIDS, correct?
HIV prevention AIDS. And education. Yeah.
And that's what you worked on. How do you look back on that experience of, given where you were then, where we are now as a nation talking about many of these issues still? And thinking, and certainly in terms of acceptance and all of the things that you were working on as an activist then, and now as portraying this in a way on stage?
That's a big question, but I will try to answer it. First of all, yes, as Miss America, 90% of what I did focused on HIV and AIDS, whether it was talking to students or lobbying legislators or raising money for the local AIDS service organization. I was actually here in Albany. I had a very memorable visit. I think about halfway through my year, and it was a local AIDS organization that was presenting this group no one had ever heard of called the Backstreet Boys. And I got to introduce them. And it was a lot of girls at their first concert with their parents, which you would imagine.
Yep.
And I got to go out there and talk about, you know, staying safe and protecting yourself, you know, in inappropriate terms for that age group at a concert. Boy, they screamed a lot, but it was a precursor. You know, I think that with HIV and AIDS, the biggest, there have always been two big barriers to effectiveness. One is politics and fear, right? Even by 1997, 98, we knew how HIV was spread and we knew how to stop it. And to me, that was always a very clear right and wrong. If we know how to stop it, we should, even if people are uncomfortable talking about it. And the second thing that was really an enemy and continues to be was complacency. I am so thrilled that we've now got effective medications that allow people to live with HIV in a similar way to many other long-term illnesses. But we've got to remain vigilant about not relaxing just because it's more treatable now. It doesn't seem like as much of a public health emergency because people aren't just dying all the time.
Right.
But it's definitely still a threat. And there are overtones of, you know, the AIDS conversation in all kinds of contexts now. I mean, even just now talking about the opiate crisis, you hear the same arguments about, I cannot remember the name of the antidote. You hear the same arguments about that you used to hear about needle exchange.
Yes.
If the antidote is available, does that mean that more people are going to habitually abuse opiate drugs? And that's you know, in scientific terms, that's an argument that's long since been settled. You know, needle exchange programs reduced the spread of HIV without a corresponding increase in the IV drug use rates. So, HIV/AIDS is still something that's on my mind quite a bit. World AIDS Day is coming up. I'm talking about maybe doing an event while we're in Tampa. And, we're in the midst of our fundraising for Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS right now. So we're doing audience appeals after the show and selling a lot of cool stuff, including some drawings by Allison, to raise money for a terrific organization.
It's great stuff. Yeah. The name of the show is Fun Home. It is currently on the stage at Proctor's Theater through November 5th. Proctors.org for more information. Proctors.org. Kate Schindel, a great pleasure to have you with us. What a delight.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You too.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.